Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, May 21st. I'm Ray Graff. Mark Lawson of Albany's Mark Lawson Antiques, Jewelry, and Coin joins us today to answer your questions. If you have recently discovered something you suspect to be a treasure and you need help figuring out what it is and what it's worth, give us a call. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. No antiques in the studio except me. And I think that's all we need right now. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. If you want to email your question for Mark, voxpop@wamc.org. Or, again, you can call us, 800-348-2551. Antique Day today, Mark Lawson. And your calls coming up right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We're discussing antiques today, and when we do that, we welcome back Mark Lawson of Albany's Mark Lawson Antiques, Jewelry, and Coin. After running a traditional antique shop and opening a gallery on Broadway in Saratoga Springs, Mark was approached by Sotheby's in 2000 to assist organizing and curating single-owner sales. He's a past member of the American Society of Appraisers and has completed courses in the NYU Appraisal Studies Program in period American furniture. He's also certified in diamond grading from the Gemological Institute of America. He travels throughout the region, meeting with clients, helping them settle estates and family treasures. You got a question? All right, this is a good time. 800-348-2551 is the number. Get in the queue. 800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Mark Lawson, welcome back. How are you?
Ray, it's great to be here. I'm lovely. The weather's so nice.
Hot enough for
you? Garden's going in. Yeah, it's it beats the heck out of snow and icy rain and all that.
I suppose you know someone's going to call in and say, you know, I prefer snow and icy rain.
Well,
there are contrarians out there, you know.
Well, I'm happy for the nice weather.
So this morning you sent me a picture, a bunch of pictures actually, of some glassware or glass items, and I put one on our page for today's show. What's the deal with those?
God bless passionate collectors.
Okay,
we have a family who has contacted us to sell the contents of their of the family home, which is filled with an endless assortment of vintage and antique perfume bottles that were collected with vigor, I mean exceptional vigor, for the last 40, 50 years. And there are literally thousands of these perfume bottles.
Wow, it's amazing. Are any worth money?
All of them are worth money, but some of them are worth some good money. As with the trends we've discussed before here, many things are not worth what they used to be worth, including, you know, all types of collectibles and probably to a certain degree perfume bottles. But it's just the scope and breadth of this collection is just something to be marveled at.
So this person was a real collector.
Real collector. She was a dealer and a collector, and she kept extensive, really nice detailed records of every single thing she bought and sold, and every single perfume bottle she bought, it was marked in her book, and there's dozens of books, NFS. She did not sell a perfume bottle. She kept them.
All right. Now, you presumably have to go through all these books.
Yes.
That sounds like a lot of work.
It is precisely that, yes. And we've been working on it for about a week, and we'll be working on it for another 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Got a big, we're going to have a giant estate sale June 14th and 15th.
Oh, really?
Yep. Yeah.
So if you're in the market for, hey, dude, not, just saying, I think I have an old Aqua Velva bottle somewhere if you need that. I don't know. You want to throw that in? So, I mean, you know, I don't understand now, but, you know, not really being a perfume sort of person. You buy the perfume and then you buy a separate beautiful bottle and pour it in? Or is this when you buy the perfume.
No, this is when you bought the perfume. Now, so there was some of the more collectible ones were made by a company called Lalique. They Rene Lalique founded the company, made beautiful Art Deco style objects out of glass in the early first quarter of the 20th century. Many perfume bottles, and the perfume bottles by Lalique became very sought after and status objects back then. Beautiful works of art, and those are some of the ones that have held the most value and are the most sought after today. And we have a fair number of them in this sale.
Well, there are about two or 300 of them in the pictures you sent. I only had room on the page for one, but you can go to WAMC.org and look at today's Vox Pop page and see what Mark is talking about. We are talking to Mark Lawson today from Albany's Mark Lawson Antiques, Jewelry and Coin. The number here is 800-348-2551. The email is voxpop@wamc.org. Around lunchtime, Tom and Gardner Mass wrote in saying, "Hey, have you ever been to the Brimfield Antiques Flea Market in Brimfield, Mass? It's quite an experience having been there these past 50 years. You ever been there?"
I have. On many occasions, I don't know in terms of it being the oldest. I think it's certainly always been the largest in the Northeast and the most kind of like prominent and well-known. The entire town of Brimfield, Massachusetts is taken over by all the antique dealers in the Northeast, as well as many who travel from all over the United States. And it's a wonderful feeding frenzy for buyers. Great place to track trends. You can go there and see what buyers are aggressively pursuing what categories, buyers from all over the world. You know, English buyers, Chinese buyers, South American buyers.
They'll come to Brimfield.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, because that's where all the stuff gets concentrated.
Huh.
So you have all the dealers bring all this latest stuff that they have found from all over there to offer it. So you have all the buyers that fly in. And then, of course, since most dealers are crazy collectors and, you know, figure out that, oh, the only way I can support this crazy habit I have is by buying and selling so I can buy more. You have all the dealers then also shopping from each other. It's a crazy hotbed of economic activity.
You know, on some various summer vacations, we would go sometimes into town or wherever we were. And in New England, there'd be a lot of antique stores.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, how do you draw that line, Mr. Professional Antique Dude, about how do you draw the line between antiques and kind of junk? Like, in other words, you go into some stores, they have some things that are very valuable, but then you might find the, you know, ceramic Conway Twitty bourbon decanter.
Well, you know, that's a great and very interesting question. I think in the trade, and all the time I've been in the trade, the proper definition of antique is 100 years old. But really, I like to default to a phrase that I learned from Joseph Campbell, speaking about objects as transparent to transcendence. That is, objects that evoke in whoever's looking at them an experience of the divine. So it's what lights people up. And that can be
a subjective thing.
Oh, totally. It's what lights people up. And that can be a McDonald's Happy Meal toy to somebody, or a $1 million piece of rare Chinese porcelain. I mean, it doesn't really matter. It's the quality of the experience and the person that loves it.
Okay, so let's go to that low end of the spectrum. Let's say in 1970.
No, but that's the highest end, though. That's the thing. That experience is the highest end. But
no, I understand. But you know. Is it an antique if in 1972 I went to a lot of Shell stations and got Roman Gabriel ceramic or mugs that they were giving out with a fill-up? I mean,
technically, no.
No, but
if you did in 1922, then yes.
Okay. Right.
It's a funny thing.
By the premise. Okay, here's one. This is from Steven. And Steven says, this Charlie Brown is 8.5 inches tall. There are faded markings on one of the foot bottoms. Do you have any idea what it's worth here? I'll show you. There's a couple pictures yep. here. There's the back of Charlie's bald head. There's the front. He's got the sweater yep. on.
I remember those. Peanuts, Charles Schulz, the Snoopy, yeah. the Red Baron, all of that.
Any idea about that
one? I was a big fan as a kid, and that looks like it dates to the late 50s or early 60s. Peanuts was a wildly popular and successful cartoon strip, and yeah. the toys and accessories that came from that were wildly popular and collectible. And here's to answer the question, widely mass produced.
Right.
And so they're fun, but today a figurine like that in decent condition might sell on eBay for $20 or $30.
Okay,
so you said interesting and saleable, but not wildly valuable because there's lots of them.
You talked about people and experts going to Brimfield and watching the trends. You can
sure.
also watch trends on auction sites like eBay.
Absolutely.
Is that
it? Although eBay has made it much less transparent over the years. When they first started, you could go on and really, and their data was wide open, and you could dig in and see how many of this sold, how many of that sold, what percentage of this and that. But as the online industries got more proficient at monetizing their data, that data became less accessible to you and me and the average Joe. Hmm. But yes, that you're absolutely correct.
All right, Mark Lawson's our guest today from Albany's Mark Lawson Antiques, Jewelry, and Coin. Let's take a break, and then we'll get to the phones. 800-348-2551. Let's hear a little blues first. Hanson Funderburg down at JJ's here on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. We're here with Mark Lawson. You know, Mark, sometimes I just want to do the DJing thing. It's not public radio exactly, but I dig it. You know what I mean?
You do it so well.
Yes. Right? Well, when I get fired, they'll say you shouldn't have done it so much. Let's go to Suffield, Connecticut, West Suffield. Hey, Tom, you're on.
Hey, thank you for taking my call, Ray, and glad to have you back. You're not only a moderator, but you're an entertainer. I love
well,
the banter
you.
Between you and the guests, and you make my day.
Appreciate it.
Nice. I agree.
I've got an Easter basket that's been, well, I've got a basket that's been used as an Easter egg basket. It's not plastic. It's not paper. It's it's like a weave on the bottom. And somebody told me that it might be Bakelite or Bakelite. Is there such a thing?
There is such a thing.
But sure. There's certainly such a thing as Bakelite, and they made all sorts of objects out of Bakelite in the first half of the 20th century. So there certainly could be an egg collecting basket. Bakelite was probably too expensive to be like a used as a container to sell eggs in, but certainly as some sort of collecting basket, that's possible. Although I've never heard of anything like that, but that's what makes the antiques business a lot of fun because you're always.
How can I tell? It has no markings on it. On the bottom, it's like a weave. It looks like a weave up and back.
So do you have a smartphone?
I do.
Okay, so you take a picture of it on a clean uniform background. And Google has the. If you go to Google Photos, there's this wonderful. Of course, now my phone's not going to work. This wonderful little thing called Google Lens.
Oh.
And you go to that. You select your.
Why are you actually doing it? That's what I want to know, Mark.
Oh, I don't know.
Because there's nothing to take a picture of.
Well, anyway, so if you open the picture in Google Photos and you go to Google yep. Lens, you can tap on it, and Google will search its entire database for an image
God.
To compare it to and identify it with. I use this all the time. I've identified old master artists and
yeah.
prints. I've identified the most obscure, curious, and confounding objects just using the power of Google and all the stuff that it's looked at.
Did it come in different colors? And
Bakelite comes in.
When was it done? When did it stop being produced?
Probably stopped in widespread use in the late 40s, early 50s.
Yeah. Okay.
And it first came in as an insulating material in it may have been something that had military applications in World War I, and then was used in the radio business and electronics business in the 20s as an insulating material.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they figured out, oh, we can make pretty looking objects out of this.
It was a precursor to plastic, Tom. I have a 1936 Philco stand-up radio, with shortwave and AM and stuff. The buttons were gone. It was in my grandmother's attic for years and years. Still worked when my brother and I pulled it down in the 70s, and the buttons were gone. So I had to have the radio because it was Bakelite, and it's fragile stuff. That's why I say it's woven. Is it an actual, Easter basket? I'm trying to picture this.
Well, it was used as an Easter basket by my mother. I don't know. It's Easter basket shape. But I don't know if that was its original usage, but it's been around for 40, 50 years.
Well, don't drop it, because if it's real Bakelite, it will shatter. That's why there isn't.
It looks like it's very fragile.
Yeah, that's why there isn't. You know, there is Bakelite around, but if you find something that is Bakelite that is complete and not destroyed, it's quite something. So, you got something.
Very good. And Ray, don't leave us like you did these past couple of days, because, like I say, you're my entertainment for the day.
Hey, man, thanks. It's great to be back, and I appreciate it very much. And Tom, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Mark Lawson, Albany's Mark Lawson Antiques, Jewelry, and Coin. And now let's go to Hudson. Austin, you're up.
Hi there. Welcome back, and good luck with the lockbox this year.
Ooh, thanks for reminding me.
I'm wondering, sir, if you do cello appraisals or have any kind of insights into those. I've inherited my grandmother's cello, and it was restored by a Scarampella in 1885. And the insurance company asked me what it's worth, and I said, how would I know? So now I'm actually really curious. I'm just wondering if you do that kind of musical instrument sort of thing.
When it was sometimes, yes, I'm a generalist, and I have done appraisals on stringed instruments in the past, cellos, basses, violins, that sort of thing. Is when it was restored, was there any attribution or identification of the maker made? Would be the first question.
Not the maker that I've found, unless it's in a place I wouldn't even know to look. There's just a Restaurato G. Scarampella in Firenzeano, 1885. And that's all I've got to go on as far as I'm aware of right now.
Yeah, that's a good sign. You know, it suggests that it was valuable and desirable enough of an instrument over 100 years ago to have significant resources devoted to its restoration and or conservation. So that's a good sign. For this, you really need a specialist in antique stringed instruments. The place that I've had the most luck referring people to is the musical instruments department at Skinner. Skinner Galleries, it's an auctioneer in Boston, Massachusetts, and they have had a very active and expert musical instruments department for decades, and I would refer you to make an inquiry there, maybe give them a phone call, see if they would have a specialist that you could send an image to.
That's great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Hey, Austin,
good
thanks
luck.
A lot. And thanks for reminding me about the lockbox. Let's just take a moment here, Mark
Lawson.
Okay,
indeed.
Our lockbox is open at wamc.org. We got a fun drive June 10th. And if there's a tremor in my voice, it's because it's a lot of work. And it's a lot of work for everybody who's listening. Because frankly, it's a pain in the backside. So what you can do now is make a pledge. Do it before June 10th. put it in the lockbox, will shorten the drive and ease everyone's pain. WAMC.org is the place to go. There's a secure online pledge portal. There's premiums, a go-go. You can find all kinds of things. WAMC.org. Don't worry. I'll mention it again ad nauseum. Nate says, any idea on silver coin for quarters? Any year worth more than others?
Well, the up into from 1795 or so up until 1964, coinage for usage in the United States was made out of 90% silver.
Yeah.
Most of the 20th century, 90% silver in the trade is called junk silver because it was made in such great quantity. It has no collectible value, but it's worth much more than its face value today because of its silver value.
Yeah.
Today, you're somewhere between, somewhere north of 15 times the face value. So a silver dollar or a
quarter, just, $6.
Right. There you go.
Yeah.
You're good. Half dollar. No, actually, $7.50, and it would be like $3.75 for the quarter. But
I mean,
that's just the silver value. And that material trades in the marketplace quite a bit because there's the industrial demand for silver is like double what comes out of the ground. So,
yeah.
The industry depends on recycling, which happens a lot.
Now, there are, of course, some rare ones in there that'll be worth significantly more than the silver value. So you get a red...
Earlier. You got to go back
to probably... Get a red book and take a look.
To the early 30s, 1920s, to begin to have a chance of finding stuff like that. And even then, it's going to need to be coins that are in exceptionally high grade, good condition.
We found,
but sure.
You know, I think I've told you before, you know, my wife and I like to do metal detecting out in the backyard. It's great if you
nice.
Like to find rusty nails. We found many of them. They're surprisingly not worth that much.
How about the pull tops from...
We get those, too.
Soda,
yeah, from 1970s cans of Mr. Pibb. No, we found... She got me a metal detector for Christmas. We went out. First thing I find is a 1943 Mercury dime.
Nice.
Yeah, it's worth like three something just for silver alone.
Well, one something, but sure.
One something? What are you talking about?
$1.50, $1.60.
You're wrong. It's $3. I'll give it to you for two. All right, let's go back to the phones. And Craig and Beacon, you're on with Mark Lawson.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I appreciate what I've heard so far. And I think perhaps the advice you gave to caller Tom might fit in my situation. But if you don't mind, I would like to pose the question to you just the same. So many years ago, my wife and I bought a dresser. The dresser measures roughly 3 feet by 5. It's a heavy dresser. It's made out of oak. It has dovetailed drawers. What's unusual about it to us is all of the handles are very ornate. They appear to be brass. There's almost an image of what looks like an owl in the center of the large handles, but they're very frilly. They're very ornate, and I haven't tried using Google Lens, but over the years I've done some research at libraries online, and we can't seem to find out anything at all about this dresser.
So by your description,
from what I'm describing, does any of it sound familiar to you?
Yes, and especially from the description of the hardware, there was oak furniture was very popular in the 1890s around the turn of the century. And, you know, with general kind of like slightly curved lines and very often ornate hardware, sometimes with a north wind's face, sometimes with some sort of allegorical creature and ornateness and you know, pierced fernery, whatever. So it sounds very much like a piece of oak furniture from the 1890s or so. And it used to be that if it retained its original kind of like golden aged surface that is the original finish. They called in the trade, they called it golden oak. That sold for a bit of a premium. But it sounds, you know, oak is a lovely hardwood, lasts forever, shrinks very little. So I see a lot of, to this day, I often see oak dressers that are in perfect condition and suitable for use in the home that'll probably be good for at least another 100 years if kept out of, you know, extremes of moisture and heat. So I kind of, my first educated guess would be a dresser from that period. Is it going to be worth an awful lot? Probably, you know, commensurate with a decent piece of, the value of a decent piece of good quality used furniture, you know, a couple, $300 on a good day. It could be worth more if there's something exceptional about it that, you know, has not been revealed in our discussion up till now. But sounds like a beautiful piece of furniture.
All right, Craig, thanks a lot. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Joan wants to know, where can she find an appraiser that specializes in antique Chinese pottery and porcelain?
There are many specialists. I'd be happy to refer to one if she wanted to send us pictures. I've done business for years with and I was working at Sotheby's with Lark Mason. He was Sotheby's' man in China for 20 or 30 years, and I have a good working relationship with him to this day. If she wants to send us images, marklawsonantiques@gmail.com, I'd be glad to give her a referral and or forward the pictures to Lark.
Yeah. Now, remember, Joan, that when you do that, you're going to get an automated email back from Mark, because I get that every time remind him about a show. And they say, well, thank you for your interest in Vox Pop. But that's the way you do business properly, right? You always get back to me in a couple of few days.
Sure. Yes.
All right. So, and by the way, you said Sotheby's. All these years that I've been saying it, I kind of throw that extra third syllable in the middle. I say Sotheby's. Is that wrong?
Well, I always say tomato, so
So let's call the whole thing off. Good. I'll call it a day. We'll go up to OTB. The number here is 800.
How about Rensselaer or Rensselaer?
Oh God, that drives me nuts. Have you heard me talk to people about that?
No, I haven't. So I stepped right in it. Huh?
Catherine Sheehan, who is of course Rensselaer, county historian, and she is over at the Hart Clewitt Museum. We've had this discussion, and no one can tell me why the city is one pronunciation and the county is the other. I think it's wrong.
My grandfather said the only way you can tell a true native of Miami, Florida, is they pronounce it Miami.
They sure do.
Yep.
And you can find an Albanian by... someone who says Albany.
There you go.
Hey,
oh,
the temperature
you're right.
In Albany, and I find myself doing it too because I'm from around these parts. Let's go to Rotterdam. Colleen, you're on.
Hello.
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 Hi. So about a month ago, my husband's father had passed away, and he received a box with in the 60s, maybe in the 70s, they had these little coin collecting blue books that the kids put together.
Mm-hmm.
And it has the entire collection of the 1941 silver pennies.
Silver pennies?
Yeah, so 43.
The stainless steel.
Or they're zinc-coated steel, yes.
Yeah,
so the question is, you know, I went online just to see because somebody told me they may be valuable, and there's a whole array of information that's just overwhelming. So what do you do if you want something like that looked at?
Well, I'll just, before you get too excited, if they're in average circulated condition and they don't have any rust on them, they'll be worth between 5 and 10 cents each. If they're in beautiful uncirculated condition with a nice shiny brand new, as if they just came off the press, they might be worth a dollar or two. So
they made a lot of them.
They made a lot of them. The rarity is the ones that they made out of copper.
So that's 1943. They used the same die set?
Yes.
And instead of steel, copper, and a handful, right?
And that'll be five or six known and worth over $1 million today.
Yeah. Do you have one of those, Colleen?
Yeah. No, I don't know if there's 43s in there. I'd have to look. I know it was a D something. So those, it's the
43 are the only ones that are going to look silver in color. And there's steel plated with zinc to, you know, minimize rusting.
There you go.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Thanks, Colleen.
My pleasure.
And we do a dedicated stamp and coin show with David Tripp and Bob Scott every 3 or 4 months. And I think we have another one coming in a month or two. Although, you know, I don't even know what's coming up later in the week. I have it written down, but let's go to Monroe, New York. And Leslie, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
I have an autograph from 1984 by Stephen Stills from Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Mm-hmm. He was performing at a campaign rally for Gary Hart, and we saw him and asked for his autograph, so it's addressed to me.
Nice.
Stephen Stills, and then he drew the picture of a heart and the sort of hashtag 84. So I've just always sort of wondered.
Oh, cool.
What the value of something like that might be.
What's it written on?
Rolling paper. No. What's it written on?
it's just on a small, maybe 3x6 rectangle of paper that my mother had in her bag.
Nice.
Just from a little notebook or something.
Sure. So autographs of, you know, music celebrities from this period are more common than uncommon generally. What makes this one a little bit nicer is he did the little extra illustration of the heart on it for you. So that makes it a little bit better. But still, I'm thinking to somebody that really cares, it might sell for something like $30 or $40, something
cool.
like that. A little bit of interest, a little bit of value, but I'm sure it has much more value than that to you. So I'm happy that you got it and it means something to you.
All right, we got to take a break. We're overdue. Leslie, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be back with Mark Lawson. Jeff Beck and friends there, the Peter Gunn theme. I think an album they recorded live in celebration of Les Paul's 90th birthday, if my memory, which is increasingly Civ-like, is correct. Well, it might be the case, it might not, but ultimately, who cares? This show's about antiques. Mark Lawson is here from Mark Lawson Antiques, Jewelry, and Coin. Let's grab a couple emails here, and then we'll move on to the phones once again. JP writes in, looking for recommendations for an old collectible book collection appraiser. Most of them do have to do with Arctic exploration, Shackleton, et cetera.
Nice.
First editions, great condition. That's from JP.
The best guy in the area, Dennis Holtzman at Dennis Holtzman Antiques in Cahoes. He's a specialist in books and historical memorabilia, so that sounds like something that would be exactly up his alley.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, you're very free in talking about what should be your competitors. Is there a collegial sort of vibe among the antique
folks? Absolutely. We all work together. I mean, the good guys anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and you get to know who the decent folk are. And yeah, we a couple things. One, I only like to refer people to experts or, you know, dealers that I would refer my family to I would trust 110%. And these are all, and I also like to refer people to, and what I got that confidence with people by getting to know them over many years. Dennis, I've done business with for 20 or 30 years,
right.
You know, and most of the guys that I talk about or places like Skinner, you know, these are places that I've developed a relationship with over decades. Yeah. So, you know, I'm completely confident in them.
All right. This email from Tom in Woodstock. I had inherited my grandfather's 14-karat gold pocket watch and chain from the 20s prior to his premature death in 1927. As a child, I played with it and unfortunately broke the cover glass face, maybe overwound it, so it doesn't work anymore. Does anyone refurbish these, or should I just sell for the bulk gold? And that's from Tom in Woodstock.
Well, that's a great question, and I run into this a lot. If you want to fix it up and refurbish it, it's got to be as a labor of love. Generally, because there's so much less interest in pocket watches as collectibles, unless it's got a really fancy movement or it's special by virtue of who made it, the money that you put into it to get it going again, you won't get back, it won't increase its value a commensurate amount. So again, it's something that you do just because, oh, you want to have grandpa's pocket watch running again.
That's it.
If the goal is to keep it and pass it down in the family, you know, there's a great guy up in Brunswick, Howard Toftegard at Howie's Jewelers. He's like one of the last 100 odd certified master watchmakers in the United States. His wait time is long because he's got a lot of people looking for him to do things. But he's awesome, and that would be a place where you could get it fixed up. But it's going to cost you a minimum $300 to $400 and possibly more depending on what it really needs.
Okay, now one more email and then we'll get back to the phones. Mark Lawson is here from Mark Lawson Antiques Jewelry and Coin. Number is 800-348-2551. This is a cool one. This is from Chris. I have an 11-foot long Cuban mahogany dining table that has been in my family since the mid-1700s. I've considered selling it, and a guitar maker offered me $14,000 for it, while everyone else says about $1,000 intact. What gives?
Well, the interesting question. I learned surprisingly and quite pleasantly for a couple of consigners the premiums that good Cuban antiques sell for. So I would definitely hold off on accepting the $1,000 offers. That sounds like an exceptional piece of furniture. I mean, go find an 11-foot piece of mahogany someplace. I mean, it's unheard of. And there are dealers in the Miami area that I've dealt with in the past. The bottom line is, as a Cuban antique, potentially with some family provenance, it has potential to be worth closer to the $10,000 than the $1,000.
Interesting. But yeah. If the luthier is offering $14K, imagine how great that guitar will be, you know?
I had a painting. A Cuban painting from a family that we put up at auction, and it brought, I don't know, $4,000 or $5,000, and I was very happy. 10, 15 years later, the same family gave me another painting, and I simply put it, I offered it to a dealer, and I said, well, the family doesn't know what they want for it. How much will you pay?
Yeah.
And the guy paid like, you know, $25,000 or $30,000
for
it.
Zikes.
So it was the I think for the right thing, Cuban people of Cuban heritage are very proud of their heritage and value their cultural heritage very highly. Okay. So don't discount it without further research, that's for sure.
10-4. Mark Lawson is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551. Sharon in Belchertown has been waiting a half an hour, and I think it's time. Sharon, you're on.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, thanks for waiting.
I have been looking at and liking collectibles and old things for 40 or 50 years. It seems to me when I first did, the word was always, don't repair anything, just look for something perfect. If it's been repaired, the value's way down. But that mentality seems very different now. Antiques Roadshow talk about repairs and restoration all the time.
Sure.
Shops do, people do. What do you have to say about that change?
Well, I think it depends on the type of repair or restoration. Professional repairs properly done can absolutely and often significantly improve and improve the value and preserve the value of a special antique or work of art. On the other hand, an unprofessional and common sense uninformed cleaning, repairing something can absolutely destroy the value of something. So it really, the devil's in the details. There used to be in country antiques, more to your question and your experience over time, it used to be when American antiques and Americana generally was more popular, there was a great premium paid for furniture that was untouched and unrestored that showed the wear, you know, the milk painted cabinet where the paint is worn through to the wood around the churning clasp that opens the door. And it's like they talked about it as intrinsic, that wear as being intrinsic to the history of the piece and really is a part of the piece being a historical document of how it was used and how it lived through a couple of hundred years. So that was very much more prevalent 20, 30, 40 years ago, because that whole realm of antiques in the United States was much more popular, much more prominent. So that may be a piece of what you've perceived and are talking about. Today, I don't hear about that sort of thing more often, although, you know, I certainly have held on to this idea of looking at the wear and wear and tear on something as being some sort of document of how it's lived through time. And it gives you a little bit of a window into how people lived and how it was used and that sort of thing. That being said, you know, absolutely, you know, and I've also told people on many times, I mean, if you have something that's relatively not special, but beautiful that you like and it needs fixing up. I mean, if you have $100 chest of drawers and it needs to be glued and clamped and put back together, by all means, do it, you know, to enjoy its use. You just want to be careful, I think, generally on the old pieces that have some historical importance. That's where it gets kind of critical, the restoration, conservation, okay, et cetera.
Jaron, thanks a lot for the call. Now another person who's been waiting a half an hour, Mary in Forestburg. Mary, you're on.
Hey, Mary.
Hi, thank you. I have two sculptures from Rosa Bonheur. Am I pronouncing it correct?
Bonheur.
B-O-N-H-E-U-R.
Yep, Bonheur.
Okay, Bonheur.
As, there you go.
You know, a 19th century sculpture. Anyway, one bears an exact resemblance to one I saw of hers in an antique journal called Bellowing Bull that sold for auction 2007 for over £2,000 in London.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've got the same thing, and it's signed Rosa B.
Mm-hmm.
on the base of the sculpture. Did she do, obviously, more than one? Is this a reproduction, probably? And what do you think it would be worth?
So, great question. I think she was a very popular artist. During her lifetime, many copies of the same sculpture were made. And after she died and throughout the 20th century, many, many recasts and copies were made. There's a whole kind of methodology of, you know, measuring and comparing to original sizes and stuff to get an idea whether it's original or not. And most of the time, a knowledgeable, experienced dealer, just by looking at the surface, looking at the quality of the casting, how it's marked or not marked, can give you a pretty good education. Mm-hmm. Guess. I'd say because her stuff was so popular and so widely reproduced, it's more likely that this is a later recast, but there's no way for you to know that for sure without having an expert take a look at it.
Right. Now, the other one is a ram, and it's signed by Bonheur. Who is he or her?
I don't. It could be that it's a recast and the detail on the R has been lost, so it just looks like an I now, or it may have been an artist with the same last name. I don't know off the top of my head.
All right, Mary, thanks a lot. And you said that's Bonet?
Bonheur.
Aha. All right, let's go.
B-O-N-H-E-U-R.
Right. That's easy for you to say. Merle in Argyle. Merle, you're on.
Hi. Mark? And Ray,
hello.
This is Merle, and I called the last time you were on.
Oh, great!
And
welcome
it
back.
Had to do with a painting that the wife bought for $5.
Oh yeah,
at a flea market.
Okay,
I called your office twice and left a message to make an appointment. I'm still waiting.
Okay,
sorry to keep you waiting.
We really can't do like. It's not a referral service, so we can't do that kind of business on the show, Merle.
I know that. I'm just complaining.
Fair enough.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for not telling our screener that. That makes a little uncomfortable, but appreciate it.
Well, I'll make sure that you get a call back right away,
yes,
Merle.
Yes, Merle. Thanks a lot, man. Appreciate the call. I don't mind the sentiment, but it takes up time. We're almost at the end of the show. Mm-hmm. John in Stanfordville. John, you're on.
Hi there. During the Civil War, generals and I guess other officers had fold-up chairs that they would carry around with them. We have one, I can't speak to this personally, I'm not that old, that folds up, has a kind of a corduroy seat, and has a captain's name on it, although I can't discern who it was. Any idea about this?
Without some provenance or some military or some clear identification of that compares favorably to a known Civil War used item, it's very difficult to say for sure, much less assign some value. With objects like this, the ones that are worth the most are ones that have a solid provenance that were used by a known Civil War veteran. Even better if he was part of one or more famous actions, Gettysburg, Vicksburg, all that sort of thing. So we really need more specific information to establish whether it really is what you think it might be or not. Again, I would try Google Lens is a great place to start, but you should also know that it's these types of folding carpet upholstered chairs of the 19th century were widespread in use. They were reasonably mass produced and mass distributed. Probably the most of them that you're going to come across today had nothing to do with the Civil War. But again, you got to find some similar ones with documentation or some family history that supports that to be able to take it further.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much. Mark Lawson, if people want to get in touch with you, say Merle in Argyle wants to get in touch with you,
sure.
How do they do it?
My website, Mark, it's marklawson.com. We do, as our call from Merle might suggest, we get a large volume of calls and are often significantly behind.
You're
and
a one-man
certainly
show,
miss
right?
things. Well, I do have a little bit of help, thank goodness. But it's a small operation. So we do the best we can and are always make a point of responding to every inquiry,
all right.
Eventually.
Except Merle. But that's okay.
Well,
keep
we're
trying.
Not done yet.
Keep trying, Merle. Hey, Mark Lawson, thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Oh, I'd love to. It's great to see you again, Ray. And welcome back. So good to have you back on the show.
It's only been a few days. And thanks to Sarah LaDuke, who kicks veritable butt doing this show. She's great at it. And Sarah, thanks for filling in the last few days. Support comes from George Propane, Goshen, Massachusetts. Family-owned and operated for over 75 years, serving Western Massachusetts with propane on full-service heating and plumbing installation, services, and deliveries, georgepropane.com. Foresight Land Services, for over 50 years, offering civil engineering, land surveying, planning, and environmental permitting to private and municipal clients in the Berkshires and Eastern New York, foresightland.com. and Empire Exhibits and Displays, producing customized product displays at museum environments for over 60 years. Empire provides in-house design, production, and project management, crafting exhibits from start to finish. EmpireExhibits.com. Thanks again to Mark Lawson. He'll be back again in the near future. Thanks for calling. Thanks to Zach, our engineer. Ed Rosen screened the calls. Tomorrow, it's Travel with Gene Gagnon. See you at 2:00.